Blog Talk Radio.
Internet world, and welcome to the Cross in the Desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. Clear my throat there. I want to welcome you to the Thursday edition of the Cross in the Desert. Got a very special program for you today in so many ways. Today, paying tribute to a dear brother, an Iranian martyr for peace and freedom in Iran, and I'm speaking of Akbar Mohammadi. A little bit later on, in just about a half an hour, my good friend, my Iranian friend who lives in Malaysia, Paymaneh Sabat, is going to be my special guest, and she's going to call in all the way from Malaysia, and we're going to talk about the subject of women. What does the Quran say, and how do women, how are they treated in Iran? We're going to discuss that and many more things. Also, later on in the program, I'm featuring once again a new section of The Cross in the Desert. It's really a relatively new program. It's called The Sound Check. The Sound Check is where I take prominent bands, most of them are Christian artists, and talk about their success, feature their songs, and also talk about their spiritual journey to Christ. Today, a very well-known band that you've known for the last, about 16, 17 years or more. We're going to feature the music of Creed and the spiritual journey of Scott Stapp, who has battled addiction and bipolar disease and has had a very difficult journey. But nonetheless, we're going to hear from him as he talks about his book, Sinner's Creed, which, by the way, we carry that book at the bookstore where I work, Family Christian. And so it should be a really interesting interview. Hang on to your hats for that one. That's going to be in about an hour from now. But I want to begin today talking about my dear friend Nazrin Mohammadi's brother. It was 9 years ago this week that she received the horrible, shocking news that her brother Akbar Mohammadi had finally died from his injuries after being tortured for more than 7 years in Evin prison. The story of Akbar has been the subject of my book, The Cross in the Desert. I have his story inside my book, and so I think the best way to acquaint you with who Akbar is, the first thing I'd like to do is to read this blog from my book, The Cross in the Desert, which is dedicated to Akbar Mohammadi. Akbar wrote a poem shortly before he died. It was called The Light of Injustice, and he writes, "The light of injustice will not burn forever. If it burns one night, it will be extinguished tomorrow." On July 30th, 2006, 34-year-old pro-democracy activist Akbar Mohammadi died in Evin prison after enduring 7 long years of grueling torture at the hands of the brutal Iranian regime. He had been arrested in 1999 after taking part in the student uprising demonstration, the largest pro-democracy movement since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Akbar spent most of his incarceration enduring long hours of interrogation, beatings, and torture. A week before his death, he had been on a hunger strike, protesting the refusal by authorities to allow him to seek medical treatment for his injuries. Akbar is just one example of the many thousands of political prisoners who are silenced by a brutal regime for speaking out against the gross human rights violations that occur daily in Iran. Freedom of speech and freedom of religion is a precious gift that most of us enjoy, but in Iran, the gift of freedom and democracy is only a hope and dream in a society ruled by Islamic law. Today is a very painful day for my dear friend Nazrin Mohammadi. Nazrin is Akbar's sister. She loved her brother and was very close to him. Since his death, Nazrin has worked very hard to keep her brother's vision of peace and freedom alive. One way she has accomplished this is by publishing Akbar's prison diary that describes in detail the beatings and torture he endured on a daily basis. Ideas and Lashes, The Prison Diary of Akbar Mohammadi, is a powerful book that describes what it was like for Akbar in Evin prison. Akbar vividly describes the long, grueling hours of interrogations, repeated questions, demand for answers, and even when he told the truth, the interrogators responded by beating the bottom of his bare feet with steel cables until he passed out. Daily floggings, no medical treatment, and very little sleep between endless interrogations was the daily routine for Akbar. At one point, Akbar was handcuffed and hung upside down, a painful and agonizing form of torture designed to force him to reveal the names of other students involved in the demonstrations. Yet Akbar refused to tell and remained loyal to his friends until the very end. Nazrin writes, Ideas and Lashes, that her brother gave his life for democracy and freedom for his fellow citizens. She also pointed out that Akbar stood up against the injustices of his fellow cellmates, and for that reason alone, he was subjected to more beatings and torture. Quote, whenever our family sent him cash in jail, Nazrin writes, he would immediately share it with his cellmates, keeping the least account and amount for himself. End quote. In spite of the painful suffering Nazrin and her family endured following the sad death of her brother, there is a glimmer of justice in all of the tragedy. Nazrin and her brother Manacher were invited to the White House by President George W. Bush and honored for their courageous fight for freedom in Iran. The fight for freedom and human rights in Iran is an ongoing struggle that continues to claim the lives of many brave protesters. In the midst of his captivity, Akbar wrote a poem of hope, a light in the darkness that looked forward to the day that the struggle would finally come to an end. In the midst of his suffering, Akbar clung to the hope for a free Iran one day. The light of injustice will not burn forever. It will burn for one night. Its fire will be extinguished tomorrow. How long will sorrow be the joy of my existence? Much sin has been committed in your name, O freedom, on the threshold of execution gallows, torture racks, and prison. They drink wine and raise their glasses in your name, O freedom. The dark nights are over, my friend, and we will see the dawn when the sun rises on the edge of freedom. A poem by Akbar before he died in Evan Prison. I want to take you right now to a very special interview from this past April that Nazreen Mohammadi had on the Rick Amato Show, America One, and you're going to hear it right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
Our Mamaluk of the day. All right, moving on now. Imagine a world where what you put on Facebook or who you say you love could land you in prison or even worse, facing execution. That's what's happening in Iran today. And joining me this time is a woman by the name of Nazreen Mohammadi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes.
Nazreen Mohammadi, you are a Iranian-American human rights activist and political activist. You're here to expose our viewers across America the ugly truth of what is happening in Iran and what's happened historically. Your brother was tortured and murdered by the Iranian regime.
Yes.
Your parents are currently in prison in Iran.
They were in prison in Iran. They are like as a hostage in Iran. They have a U.S. green card. They're supposed to be citizen in here. When 3 years ago, they flew back to Iran to visit my older brother, and the Islamic regime didn't allow them to come leave the country.
So
they are like a home arrest in Iran.
Home arrest.
Yeah.
Let's start with your brother.
Yes.
He kept a diary of his imprisonment before he was tortured and
yes.
murdered. Why was he imprisoned, tortured, and murdered?
We knew there is no human rights in Iran. It was a huge demonstration rally in Iran 1999. Students were on the street, more than 100,000 students were over there, and many people joined to them. In that day, the regime arrested my two brothers, Manuchehr and Akbar, and they kept them, and we didn't know more than 4 months, and the regime tortured them a lot. And after 7 years, my brother went to jail under torture regime, killed him because he believed human rights, he believed democracy, and he believed secular government. And regime was afraid of him, and they called him as a brave student freedom fighter. And that reason, Islamic regime of Iran killed him under torture. He had a big support. Amnesty International, after he was killed, sent a letter to the whole world and sent a condolence to my family. State Department of United States supported, because he was innocent, and against the Islamic regime, they sent a letter to the whole world, but regime was
right.
afraid of him and
so,
killed.
So he's a political dissident, and the Iranian regime feared his voice of opposition.
Yes.
All right, and he believed in democracy, as you say.
They don't believe.
Brother did.
Yes.
All right. Now, your parents, as you pointed out, are under sort of like a house arrest, not allowed to leave the country.
Yes.
Why? What is it that the Iranian government fears about your parents that they are treating them such a way?
There is a very good question. 2 weeks ago, I listened to Mr. Rouhani's speech, and he said there are just 3% of people who are against Islamic regime of Iran, and they want regime be changed in Iran. We are not allowing them to come in and out of Iran. But my parents, they are not political activists. They are just parents, and they lost their children. The regime has a fear, and they took them as a home arrest. Even my brother, regime killed by themselves. They buried my late brother by themselves. They were afraid of his dead body. For more than a month, they had a guard on his grave.
So essentially, if I understand what you're saying, the regime says, listen, we killed the son of this mother and father,
yes.
so we cannot trust them to ever not be a risk to the regime in Iran, is basically...
Regime is very big, Islamic regime, yes. They are afraid.
So, now President Obama says, listen, we've got to see beyond our differences. Let's show good faith, and our negotiation partner will show good faith. Is that a good strategy?
I don't believe that. Islamic regime of Iran cannot be trusted to be negotiation. And when is country. There is no democracy. There is no human rights. How can we negotiate it? When regime doesn't have a mercy to own people, they are worse than the Hitler. And we knew that. But President Obama doesn't care. He, President Obama, passed his time to sit down with this Islamic regime. Everybody knows this is the biggest terrorist to the whole world. He wasting his time and to sit down with them, but he didn't want to listen to when there was a demonstration. 1999 was a student demonstration, and about 5 years ago was another demonstration, and a student on the street, they were chanting, "Obama, Obama, are you with us or with Mullah?" But President Obama was with Mullah.
In fact, he said, "We do not meddle in the affairs of others." Listen, yes. Nasrin Mohammadi, I'm sorry about your story. I mean, it's a tragic story, but it is important that you're doing what you're doing, getting the word out there, particularly at a time. You know, it's interesting to me is we see the left in America jump upon Governor Mike Pence of Indiana, saying that he's discriminating against gays because he's allowing business not to sell wedding cake to a gay couple based upon their religious beliefs. But no one is talking about the horrendous human rights acts, which are thousands, not even comparable to what's happening in Indiana, with a country which President Obama is trying to cut a nuclear deal with. You want to say something?
Yes, I want to talk about this.
Quickly, please.
Yes. President Obama, even in Iran or any country else, we don't have basic human rights. How can we talk about nuclear when we don't have human rights? Right now, Mr. Jason Rezaian, who is an American-Iranian, and Amir Hechmat and Pastor Saeed Abedini, they are American-Iranian, but they are in Iran. We cannot do anything. We don't have human rights. First, bring human rights. And after that, you can talk about the nuclear. And all media, they are talking about nuclear, but we don't talk about human rights.
An important point, and Nasrin Mohammadi, you're a great spokesperson for that point. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you.
All right, when we come back, our Grassroots Citizens panel, and we will announce the winner of this week's viewer contest.
That, of course, was back in April, prior to the signing of this disastrous nuclear deal. I want to take just a minute here to comment on what Nasrin was talking about. I want to read something from my friend Sholi Pakravan. Sholi is the mother of Rehana Jabari that was executed this past October. She was executed for defending herself against a rapist. Her picture is on the front of my latest book. Her story is inside the book. This fall, I will be researching and writing a biography about Rehana Jabari, and it is my honor and privilege to do that. I'm so thankful to Sholi, who's going to help me with fueling a lot of information about Rehana. Her family members, her sisters, will all share some personal insights about their sister Rehana. Sholi has shared an awful lot already. I look forward to this incredible project of writing a book about Rehana. But Sholi had something to say about this nuclear deal, and she had a post on Facebook, and my good friend Paymanay, who's going to be here in a few minutes, did the honor of translating it. I want to read this story. There's a picture of Rehana with a noose around her neck in the middle of the negotiations of the nuclear deal when they were going on these past few months. And there's a picture of Rehana there in the center of their negotiations, and there's a picture of a noose around her neck. And I want to read to you what Sholi says. "This picture burns my heart. I don't want to believe that these men only worship financial profits and dollars earned from oil. I don't want to accept that hundreds of Rehanas swinging and hanging on the noose, but those who love this world are only gazing at the digits of their currency accounts with their greedy eyes. It is not easy to believe that the economic authorities in Europe, who travel to Iran frequently and they pretend that they don't know or don't mind that their money has been earned at the price of the mother's tears and their children's bloods, How is it possible to ignore the state of execution, the rate of execution? How is it possible to talk about dollars, seeing the eyes of the mothers of Sitar and Amir Ashad and Mustafa without any care? How is it possible to see how restless Saeed's mother is and ignore her? The way that she has been looking for her son, a part of her soul and her being, during all of these 16 years, that even if she had iron shoes, they would be torn by now if she was wearing them. How can one see the eyes of Netta Sultan's mother with blood instead of tears in them and tolerate it? How can one look and see the deformed and injured faces of acid attack victims and do not care? How is it possible to show no reaction toward the way judges move their pens on the paper writing the word execution? How is it possible to see billions of dollars have been stolen from poor Iranians and there is no care? How marvelous would it be the day when the old colonialism by the West disappears in Iran, even in its modern appearance of the third millennium? How marvelous it would be the day when those who pretend they are standing for humanity be aware of their real duty. How marvelous it would be to see the day when humanity, and only humanity's life, is considered the holiest thing all over the world. How marvelous it would be to see the day when the mothers who have cried out for justice will see their broken hearts get justice. How wonderful it will be to see the day when the value of humans' blood is higher than billions of dollars and euros earned through oil. Sholeh Pakravan, lamenting where our priorities are in the face of human rights violations, death and injustice. And now I want you to hear a very special interview with Senator Ted Cruz, who's running for president in 2016, on the Sean Hannity program, talking about this disastrous nuclear deal. Let's listen right now on The Cross in the Desert.
Welcome back to Hannity. So the president's wrapping up his trip to Africa. He managed to find some time to fire a few quick jabs at the GOP presidential field during a press conference in Ethiopia. The president took some cheap shots at Governor Mike Huckabee and Ted Cruz. Watch this.
The particular comments of Mr. Huckabee are, I think, part of just a general pattern that we've seen that would be considered ridiculous if it weren't so sad. I mean, we've had a sitting senator called John Kerry Pontius Pilate. We've had a sitting senator who also happens to be running for president suggest that I'm the leading state sponsor of terrorism. These are leaders in the Republican Party.
Here with reaction, author of the bestseller, Time for Truth, Reigniting the Promise of America, 2016 Republican presidential contender, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Senator, the Iranians right now are not abiding by the deal. They wouldn't let the IAEA inspect their nuclear detonator sites. And we're giving them $150 billion, and we can't get a deal that releases four Americans and says they've got to recognize Israel's right to exist? What is he talking about here?
Well, you know, unfortunately, with President Obama, it's all politics all the time. It speaks volumes that he's halfway across the globe, and he feels the need to attack me directly. And it's interesting, Sean, he didn't actually dispute the substantive criticism. So the point that he responds to there is I've pointed out that under the Obama nuclear deal, over $100 billion will flow to Iran. Iran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, so much of that money will end up in the hands of Hamas and Hezbollah and the Houthis and other radical Islamic terrorists. And if this deal goes through, the Obama administration will become quite literally the world's leading financier of radical Islamic terrorism. Now, President Obama didn't dispute that. He didn't point to any entity on earth that would send more money to radical Islamic terrorism. He didn't dispute that billions of dollars in the control of the American government will be used to fund jihadists who will take that money and murder Americans, murder Israelis, murder Europeans. Instead,
Senator,
he simply attacked us.
$150 billion, based on their economic size, is the equivalent of $8 trillion to the U.S. economy. All right, I want to go to what you...
Well, and I'll tell you real quickly, Sean, since he's not willing to discuss the substance, I'll make an invitation right here tonight, which is I will invite President Obama at any time and place of his choosing to debate the substance of the Iran deal. Let's do it in front of the American people anytime in the next 60 days that Congress has to review this deal. If he's so convinced he's right on the substance, I will welcome him anytime. And if he's unwilling to show up, he can send as a proxy John Kerry. Let's debate the substance of how much this endangers the United States of America, Israel, and the world. It's the single greatest national security threat facing America.
You gave a powerful floor speech on Friday, which you stated that Mitch McConnell had lied to you. And this was about the import-export bill, basically corporate cronyism, where we, I guess, back up, give loan guarantees to billions of dollars the taxpayers do. Did he or did he not say to you, there is no deal, that this wasn't going to come up? Because that's the crux of it. Either what he said to you is true or not true.
Right.
What is the bottom line?
He said it multiple times back in May when we were debating Trade Promotion Authority, TPA. I asked him at a Senate lunch. It looked like a deal had been cut to reauthorize the corporate welfare that is the Export-Import Bank. And I asked him, what deal did you cut? And he said three times, there is no deal, there is no deal, there is no deal. He said it not just to me, but to all the other Republican senators. And Friday on the Senate floor, I recounted, here's what he said. And his actions were directly contrary.
All right. There's a poll that came out, and it's fascinating. The Republicans have lost 18%.
Yep.
Here's
yep.
what I'm trying to understand. In 2013, every Republican, when they were running in 2012, 2010, they all said they'd repeal and replace Obamacare.
Yep.
They voted to do it when it didn't matter, symbolically, mm-hmm. but when it came to defunding it and using their constitutional power, you stood alone. I think there were two other senators that joined you, or three other senators in the well as you went through your filibuster, on issues of immigration, mm-hmm. health care. Time and again, why do they keep caving? And are they not understanding the American people are fed up that they're not mm-hmm. keeping their promises?
Well, it's even worse than that. It is Republican leadership that is leading the effort to kill conservative principles. And the sad reality is Republican leadership, they're not listening to you and me. They're not listening to the conservatives who elected them. They're instead part of what I call the Washington cartel, career politicians.
Well, these are some very important remarks. I wanted to end the interview there because it went beyond what I wanted to talk about. The number one state sponsor of terrorism, if Congress approves this deal and does not vote it down, millions of dollars will flow to support and to increase the tentacles of Iran with terrorism all over the world. Can you fathom this? This deal did not address human rights. This deal did not free four Americans. This deal instead empowers Iran as the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Added to that, this little tidbit. Did you know that in 2009, the daughter of Secretary of State John Kerry, Dr. Vanessa Bradford Kerry, John Kerry's younger daughter by his first wife, married an Iranian-American physician named Dr. Brian Balanahid. And, of course, you're not aware of it. Brian Nahid is son of Nushin and Reza Valeh Nahid of Los Angeles. Brian's Persian birth name is Behrouz Valeh Nahid, but it is now shortened and Americanized in the media to Brian Nahid. At the time his engagement to Bradford Kerry, he was rarely any mention of Nahid's Persian-Iranian ancestry. Wonder why? Do you think Secretary Kerry should have recused himself from the negotiations with Iran at the very outset because of his long-standing relationship to his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif? Well, Zarif, of course, is the current Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Rouhani administration and has held various significant diplomatic and cabinet posts since the 1990s. He was Kerry's chief counterpart in the nuclear deal negotiations. It is amazing. The conflict of interest. Now you ask the question why this deal was so readily approved. It is amazing to me how this happened. And yet we are witnessing also a secret deal that is going on between the United States and Iran. Continues to baffle my mind how this happens. Well, right now it is my pleasure to introduce to you my dear Iranian friend, Peymaneh Sabet. Peymaneh is an Iranian Christian refugee currently residing in Malaysia. She is a gifted journalist and an activist whose ambition is to write and speak out for her troubled country. And I want to welcome my good friend, Peymaneh Sabet, calling all the way from Malaysia this morning to the Cross in the Desert. And good evening, Peymaneh.
Good evening. Good morning. It should be morning there. Hi.
Yes, we're 13 hours difference, Peymaneh. Before we start on our subject today about the plight of women in Iran, I want you to tell in your own words, from your heart, to my listeners, what you think about this nuclear deal that my country has made with your former country, Iran. What do you think about it?
You know that I don't like this deal because it's not for my people. It's just for terrorists to strengthen terrorists. And no money goes to the people. And, you know, people lost a lot of things for this deal. And no improvement will happen to them. They will go to worse and worse. Maybe apparently something like sanctions will be less, but they miss a lot of things and they will miss more things. And it's not for their benefits. It will just make life harder for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, Peymaneh, just last week I read this heartbreaking story of some children in Iran that are homeless. They're out on the streets, and there was an accident where a car ran over a giant piece of cardboard. Underneath that cardboard was a 7-year-old child. And yet, just as you said, the billions of dollars, instead of going to help these homeless people that are suffering in Iran, these billions of dollars, if this deal is approved, will go into the pockets of mullahs to support terrorism. Isn't that tragic?
Yes. 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 No money will go to the people's pockets. I think there will not be jobs for people. The hungry people will not have food. They will not have good education. They will not renovate schools. Nothing will change. Nothing will change for good. And maybe just in appearance, they do something for people to make them happy, to make the nation just calm down. But, you know, actually, nothing good will happen to them. People will not have, they will not have their rights. No execution will decrease. No, prisoners will not be released from prisons. And now something happened to the children, teachers for their rights. Nothing will be for their benefits. So the more money will go to Palestine, to Lebanon, to terrorists, to protect other countries, but not for people, not for Iranian people. Still,
yes.
Young people will suffer. Still, there will be jobless people. Still, there will be working children, hundreds of working children in Iran. They cannot go to school. Still, everything will happen as it was before, or even worse.
Yes. Yes. Well, Peymaneh, I've introduced you as a human rights activist, an actress, a journalist. At one time, you lived in Iran, and because of your views against the government and against human rights, you had to flee. and now you're in a Christian community living in Malaysia, looking forward to the day when you can be approved by the UNHCR and find a new country for freedom. We're praying for you that this will happen very soon. Yes, I know. The difficult situation for Iranian refugees is something we can talk about. I wanted to ask you about the subject that is so important to me on my program, and it is the rights of women in Iran. You recently wrote a blog, and I put it on my Cross in the Desert post, and you had some things to say about being an Iranian woman, and I want to read them and have you talk about what the Quran teaches about women. You write, "I am guilty, not because of what I did, but because of who I am, because of whom I have been created by. I am educated. I can make money. I am a lecturer, a journalist, and an actress, but none of them covers my gender. I am humiliated because I am a woman. Men look at me as a tool, as a piece of cloth, as an amusement, as a slave, as an option, as a choice." Those are strong words. Why do you feel that way as a woman? And what does the Quran teach about women living in Iran?
Yes, exactly. Women are humiliated in Iran. As long as they are single, they have to be ruled by their fathers. All their rights belong to their fathers. Even for marriage, they have to ask their father's allowance. Just imagine a father is an addict man and the girl is a physician, but still she cannot get married without her father's permission unless she goes to some procedures in the court. After they get married, all their rights are submitted to her husband. According to the Islamic rule, women are not allowed to leave their houses without their husband's permission. If the husband says you must not see your parents, they cannot see their parents. A lot of things. They cannot travel abroad without their husband's permission. And their husbands can marry with four wives at the same time. And they can have sighah. Sighah means they can have temporary marriages. They can marry any woman they like every day, and the women cannot do anything. They cannot even complain because the court, the judicial power, everybody supports the men. Also, women, as you know, they cannot go to a stadium. Some courses in university, they cannot study in those courses. And according to Quran, just imagine Quran was sent, as Prophet Muhammad claims, it was sent centuries after Bible was written. Bible, according to Bible verses, Colossians 19, Ephesians 5:26, 28:29, 33, 1 Peter 3:7, chapter 3, verse 7, all of them say, love your wife and do not be harsh with them. Love your wife and your own as your own bodies and yourself. Take care of your wife. Love your wife just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. They say, treat with your wife with respect as the weaker partner and heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. So, some centuries after Bible said these things, suddenly Quran came and said, men can beat their wives. Quran in Nisa, that is chapter 4, verse 35, says that men can beat their wives if their wives do not follow them, do not submit themselves to their husbands. They can just first talk to them, advise them. If they do not listen to them, they can separate their bed. And finally, they can strike them. They can beat their wives. And in chapter 2, verse 223, It says your wives are as built for you. So approach your wife when and how you can you like. And many people say it's not, it's just taken out of context and it's interpreted out of context and they say something. But Quran directly told men that you can beat your wife if they do not submit themselves to you.
Right, right,
what
right. Now you brought up
find.
I was going to just add, you brought up several examples in contrast to the Quran, how God commands the husband to treat his wife with respect, to love her, even to give his life for her, as Jesus did for the church. And then you showed how the Quran gives the permission to the husband to strike or beat his wife if he suspects her of adultery, and to treat his wife like a sexual possession. So you're contrasting these two revelations from God, and you're saying to me and listeners, which revelation treats the woman with respect? And, of course, the Bible does. Now, also, and that's a great contrast. Paymanay, if a woman in Iran is being abused and she's crying out for help and her husband's beating her, she can't just divorce him because she'll lose custody of her children and inheritance. Isn't that right?
In terms of inheritance, a woman does not have as much rights as a man has. A woman's testimony and her inheritance is half of the man. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if she's abused, according to non-written law, of course the court will not support the woman, and she has to go through a very, very hard procedure. And finally, maybe she got offended by the people in the court, by the judge. Finally, they will say, okay, go and leave your husband and be thankful that he brings you money and you have food. So in terms of abusing and other things, they don't have any rights. And if they want to separate their husbands or get divorced, of course, they say that then until son age, the woman should take care of their children because the children need mother then. But still, the court supports men, and it's not easy for the woman. The woman is going to take care of the child, she cannot marry. If she marries, the child goes to the father or father's family. So if a woman wants to take care of their children, they should not get married. And just imagine that they do not have jobs or financial support. What will happen to a mother?
Yes, I want to also add to the list of the way women are treated in Iran as second-class citizens. You've heard recently, of course, of women who are victims in Isfahan of acid attacks. Their faces defigured, their lives changed forever. And simply because, according to some besiegee, or some of the paramilitary people that committed these things, the reason acid was thrown in the faces of women is because they weren't wearing their hijab correctly. And so women are discriminated against and treated horribly.
Yes, of course, they are discriminated. Just imagine what Mullah said, that you have to deal with this woman physically, and some people pour acid attack. Women even didn't know those people. Don't know who destroyed their lives. They don't know who deformed their faces and gave them a lot of suffering. And it was according to the comment of some mullahs and Islamic rules. It's called Nahi as Munkar or Amr bi Ma'ruf. It means that you have to guide people to the right path or make them avoid some sins. And everything happened because of the hijab. And because of the people who pour acid did not like their appearance. And, you know, then in terms of Gasht Irshad, when the security guards, some guards, do not like the women's appearance or do not like what they are wearing or their makeup. Even their women's husbands, fathers, brothers who are with them cannot defend them. They cannot say, we permit our wives, our sisters, our daughters to wear this one, this type of clothes. They cannot do anything. Even they can arrest their husbands, their brothers, their fathers. So nobody can protect them. So the law is against women. Nobody protects women. They just humiliate them. They just abuse them. In terms of raping, you see, if a man rapes a woman, the woman should keep quiet. Nobody should know, because if they know, the society will just isolate the woman, and she cannot live in the community, in that society. If she defends herself, you see what happens. What happened to Rehane?
Yes.
The only way they have is to do what Farinaz did. Farinaz in Mahabad, she just dropped herself from the hotel balcony and killed herself. Otherwise, if she did not do that, she would have Rehane's destiny.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about the way women are treated according to the Quran living in Iran. You're giving examples of situations where they are deformed or defaced by acid because they aren't wearing their hijab correctly. We can see a lot of horrible, unjust things against women. But there are some examples you have, Payman A, of Iranian women who have risen above these circumstances of living in Iran and have been very successful. So let's talk about something positive, about true Iranian women that have risen up above these circumstances and become very strong professional voices in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me just compare something. You know, an Iranian mullah said that it's not necessary for women to study math. Women just need to know the numbers to be able to count their children. But we have one of the biggest mathematicians in the world, Maryam Mirzakhani. she is an Iranian mathematician. She won the first medal, Fields medal. It's a very, very valuable medal in mathematics. And also we have a lot of women like Elia Sabur. Elia Sabur is the youngest professor in the world. She's Iranian, but she lives in other countries. She's the youngest professor, and she won some medals, and she's a scientist and attorney, and she holds the record for being the world's youngest professor. And we also have Minu Akhtarzadeh. She was a very successful director. She was the former director general of the Swedish National Rail Administration and the government of some country. We have Anusha Ansari. Everybody knows that. She was the first woman who traveled to the moon, and she's the manager and founder of telecom company. They have Maria Khorsan. She holds some parts in Sony Ericsson. We have a lot of successful women, but unfortunately, they are not supported by Iranian government. So they had to go out of country, and, you know, every part of the world, we have a successful Iranian woman. In Nassau, we have Iranian women. They are very successful, but they have nothing to do with Iran. Iran.
Right. In the past, before the Islamic regime took power in Iran, you look back in Persian history, you have examples of very strong, very prominent Iranian women. One of them, Mandana, the mother of Cyrus the Great. She was the founder of special schools. She taught students law and trained them to stand up against cruelty and oppression. You had Queen Shirin and Utab, a great military commander. These are examples of Persian women before the Islamic regime.
Yes, we have Atusa, we have Purandukh, we have a lot of Persian women who were commanders in war, who founded founded some charities, the school, really very successful women. The reason that women cannot tolerate the situation is that because they are aware of their past. In past, they were very, you know, they were treated like queens. They had a lot of values in the country, in Persia. Suddenly, they want to oppress them, they want to suppress them, so they cannot tolerate because they know about their rights. They were not born blind. They were not brainwashed. And we also had the queen before revolution, Mohammad Reza Shah's wife, Farah Diba, Farah Pahlavi. She was
a successful
woman, a great woman. She did many, many, many things for Iranians. She was involved in opening many museums. She was the founder of some places, and also she was involved in the center of intellectual development of young children and adolescents, the National Organization for Protection of Children, Reza Pahlavi's School for the Blind, the Organization for Protection of Mothers and Babies, and Iranian Society for Assistance to the Lepers, and the Society for Assistance to the Victims of Burns, and a lot of places, a lot of things she did for women. She was not just a queen sitting on the throne and doing nothing and using the taxes. She was very active, very creative, and did a lot of things for the people, especially women in Iran.
Yes. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I thank you for bringing that great example to us. Tell our audience a little bit about what's going on in Iran with this teacher strike, the oppression of teachers. And there has been a gathering of teachers outside of the Iranian parliament. Tell our listeners what's happening with this situation.
Yes. As you know, teachers have a lot of values in other countries. Teachers are those who make human beings, train human beings, and submit them to the society. Those who are going to make the society in the future are made by teachers' hands. But unfortunately, in Iran, they don't have any values. They don't have any, they don't have much rights, even they don't have enough salary. So they cannot fulfill their needs, and they abuse them. Last month, they arrested some teacher, and the other teachers just had a protest. It was a gathering, a peaceful gathering in front of the parliament. But they bit them, lashed them, and arrested hundreds of teachers.
Yes, and this is because a teacher, Mr. Ismail Ababdi, he's been in prison since June 27th. He's the general secretary of the Iranian Teachers Trade Association. And this protest, as you pointed out, was calling for his release, and the police there crushed the protest. Scores of teachers were arrested simply because they're calling for this man to be freed from prison.
Ismail Ababdi was one of the teachers who was abused by the government. It was one of them that everybody knows, but there are a lot of teachers, a lot of people in education who are not respected by government, who don't have their rights. Even we have a teacher who has back problem, and he is the only teacher in their village, so they could not send another teacher, and he held the classes in his house, lying on bed. He taught his students.
Such dedication. Well, Paymane, before you go right now, I just want to mention to our listeners that we're writing a book together called Stories from Exile. It's your personal testimony of being an Iranian refugee. And before we go, just tell our listeners a little bit about what life is like for an Iranian refugee.
It's not easy to be a refugee, especially an Iranian refugee, because when a person is a refugee, it means that his life is in danger. It means that he will surely be executed, and not only he or she himself, but their families are in danger. And they have, some of them have to spend a lot of time, very, very long time outside the country without any, any hope, you know. They don't know what will happen to them. And unfortunately, because there are a lot of refugees in around the world, so they do not have much chance. They just have to have hope and trust in God if they believe in God. So it's very difficult, especially in some countries, some dangerous countries like Malaysia. It's very dangerous for refugees because they don't have any rights. They haven't signed any agreement with the government in Malaysia. So there is joblessness, there is depression, there is disease, and long waiting. Even some of them cannot leave their houses. And finally, they don't know what will happen. And the most important thing is depression.
Yes. Now, you know, we write on your on my program, you write certain stories and articles about problems in Iran and the human rights, egregious human rights violations. But your focus in writing these stories for my program is to share the greatest good news in the world with Iranians, that you want to share in your stories and in your book the good news of Christ. Your goal and your passion, Peymané, is to preach the gospel to your people, to your nation, isn't it?
Yes, of course, because the most important thing, or maybe the only thing I have in the world, is Lord Jesus. Now I have nobody here, no family, nobody who can understand me. You know, in the community I live, there is a huge, huge cultural difference, and our backgrounds are totally different. People here don't know the meaning of stress, they don't know the meaning of war, they don't know the meaning of earthquake. They don't know many, they have not experienced many things I have experienced. So there is a huge difference. The only thing I have here is Lord Jesus, and the only thing that strengthened me is Him. I trust in Him, and this is why I became a refugee. This is why I found the salvation. Praise the Lord. There is no right in Iran. I have no place in Iran. My life is in danger. But still there is a hope. The person who can open all the shut doors, and he can open the doors that are shut, and nobody can shut again. So he's Lord Jesus. And now is my duty to show how hopeful he is, and to show that he is the only salvation. If you have no place to live, if you have no food to eat, he can fulfill your needs. He can nourish your spirit. He can send a lot of people to take care of you, to help you. And he can send you to a safe place if it's needed. You can be his testimony, and you can express him inside you. He can do everything for you. So you can tolerate the situation as a refugee. And, you know, he promised that he will build Iran again. And it's a great, great news for Iranians that anything they are going through now will end soon or late. I hope soon. And they will have a good life again, and they will have their rights again. But, you know, they will have freedom, not physical freedom. We are looking for their eternal life. We are looking for their redemption. So the good news to them is that they will have both freedom and redemption. They can have salvation forever and ever, and they can have a happy life forever and ever.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Payman A. I call you my goddaughter. You call me godfather. We are close, yeah. close friends. And thank you so much yeah. for sharing the good news of Jesus, the most important thing you can share with Iranian refugees all over the world. And thank you for educating yeah. us about the plight of women in Iran and the struggles that they go through. This is Payman A. Sabet calling all the way from Malaysia. Please keep her in your thoughts and prayers. Very soon she goes before the UN Council. She's looking for a home where she can worship and be free without fear and intimidation. So thank you so much. God bless you, Payman A.
You're welcome. Thank you. God bless you too.
And that's my good friend, and I just love her. She's such an inspiration to my life. And together, when she writes the articles, she writes them, I read them. I'm like a voice for her people, and it's such a privilege and such an honor. Speaking of salvation and hope, Scott Stapp, the front man from Creed, was battling addiction and bipolar disorder. It almost cost him his marriage, it almost cost him his life. And today on the sound check, I want to feature the testimony of Scott Stapp from Creed and his battle and his victory in Jesus. We're going to go right now to a new segment on the Cross in the Desert called the Sound Check. We'll be right back. Crunchy hard rock driving guitar work of Mark Tamminotti. That is the music of Creed, and the vocalist, of course, this front man was Scott Stapp. It always was a treat to see them live. They rocked the stage. They had a Christian background. The roots of their music was a spiritual journey. If you've ever seen the video, Mike's Sacrifice, it's very interesting. It's different. It opens with this older man sitting on a bench, and then you kind of see the faces kind of dissolve back and forth between Scott and the older man. And then you see his neighborhood, and you see boats, and you see people in the water, and you're thinking, what does this all mean? Well, Scott explained it's like his spiritual journey. It's how the events in his life shaped him to becoming a Christian. And then you see the water and you begin to see what he's saying. It's referring to baptism, that a radical change in your life when you believe in Christ and are baptized and your whole life is transformed. And that's kind of the meaning of My Sacrifice. When I'm with you, I am free, I am careless. I believe it's referring, I think, most prominently to the sacrifice of Christ. However, and this is why I'm featuring the music of Creed today, and they all are an alternative to a lot of the grunge music that talks about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Creed isn't like that. They've always had good, strong, spiritual, annotative lyrics, if you listen to their songs very carefully. A very prominent group, mega group. I think they had over 10 number one singles. Scott was immersed in success beyond his wildest dreams. But, however, growing up, his father hated this kind of music, discouraged him from this kind of music. The kind of lifestyle for Scott when he lived at home was harsh, legalistic. It was all in the name of love, but the way he was treated was anything but love. And so Scott carried his family upbringing with him into his successful music career. And along the way, because these are events he never had healing from, they immersed into what today is the tragedy of living with bipolar disease and addiction. It almost cost him his life, his marriage, and everything. But I want us to hear from Scott himself. He has written a book called Sinner's Creed. It's his spiritual journey, and let's listen to the first interview right now on The Cross in the Desert. Here's Scott Stapp.
Well, Sinner's Creed was, was a real journey of self-discovery. I got inspired to write it at a time in my life when, I needed to make it my confession. I needed to sort through the past and the highs and lows and really find out, what made me tick, rediscover my faith with new eyes and reconcile my past and be honest about it. I think during the dark days, as I talk about in my book, I kept believing that there was a purpose. There had to be a purpose to this. And Sinner's Creed, laid that out for me and allowed me to share my story of faith and to share my walk with God through the good times and the bad times. And I hope that, it can provide hope and a message that we're all sinners, but we can still find love and find that love from God. What's up? Well, during those dark times and times where on the outside, you know, others may feel, you know, he's completely lost his faith, he's turned away from God, he's not a Christian anymore, I was talking to God every day. You know, it was just my will, not thy will. You know, a lot of times I felt like David, you know, in the caves, hiding, and in those dark places. And I think part of the self-discovery for me is I began to wallow in that and like it to some weird degree. That was the manipulation that was going on in my mind. But I always spoke to God and stayed in touch with God. But I was angry. You know, I had a vision. I had a plan for how things were supposed to be. And, you know, it was all part of God getting me to the place where I could surrender control and you know, let the ego go and just learn to let go. And it took those times for me to get in those places where I only had one way to look, and that was up. And unfortunately, I was so hard-headed, I needed that. And so I value those times, and I'd never want to go back. But they were necessary as part of my journey of faith and God just reforming my heart. What's up? There were definitely moments where, you know, I experienced fear, apprehension in writing this book. And, you know, I had to face that. I think that one of the challenges in my life once I kind of got out in the world and was experiencing things for the first time was how to handle my fears. And, you know, in my life, I always felt inside that I had no fear, but really my fear was driving me. And so I had to confront that in this book, and I had to walk through that with clarity of mind, you know, not falling back into old habits and negative ways that I began to handle that during the rise of Creed. And, you know, there were many times, you know, in particular, you know, the stories of my childhood, the stories about what went on with Creed during the end days, you know, some of my near-death experiences that I never shared with anyone. Those were, you know, it humbled me a lot. I realized that fear, there was also a pride in there that I felt apprehensive in sharing my weakness and confessing my sin. But there's power in that. And I found that as I walked through those places, that's where the purpose in my life finally started to surface, that God had a plan. And so it was a very interesting process to overcome that. What's up? I had to discover the, you know, Christ of love. You know, the way that I was brought up, it was very black and white, very heaven and hell. You could lose your salvation in an instant, you know, walking on eggshells in the fear of eternal damnation. And through this journey, I finally, you know, found the love and the grace of God. And it was overwhelming and something that was beyond comprehension, that God could love someone so unlovable. And in truly understanding God's grace, it opened up a whole new aspect of my faith and my Christianity and my love for Christ that I never could see before because of the barriers that were put in front of my face as a young boy. So it was great to come out of that cocoon and feeling like I knew so much but really knew so little about the love of God. What's up? This is Scott Stapp. Check out my memoir, due in stores October 2nd this year. Stay in touch with all info regarding my tours, the book, what's going on in the Creed world, and recording and music and art at scottstappofficial.com. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Stapp, and follow Sinners Creed, at Sinners_Creed. God bless and rock on.
I think the title of this book is an amazing title. It's very catchy. It's right on. The focus is, look, I'm a sinner. And Scott has some real problems even today with bipolar and dealing with drugs and addiction. but he has come full circle in his recommitment to Jesus. And it reminds us that we as Christians are not perfect. It's Christ that perfects us. And that in this mortal body, we will struggle with sin until the day of heaven. And it's outlined very clearly in Romans chapter 7 that Paul says, I hate the very thing that I'm doing. I want to follow Christ. I want to obey the law of God. I want to be honorable in my relationship. But I'm doing things I hate. Therefore, we are no different than Scott Stapp. We, too, have struggles. Well, what I want to do right now is I want to feature another song from Creed. This is an amazing song as well. It's called One Last Breath, right now on the cross in the desert. Here's Creed. Of Creed, One Last Breath. I think you can probably relate to the lyrics of this song. Hold me now, I'm 6 feet from the edge, and I'm falling. It sounds like a struggle between life and death. Actually, One Less Breath was a hit single for Creed in their 2001 platinum record, Weathered. And you hear the protagonist of this song. The lyrics swing back and forth between wanting to continue and feeling hopeful, then to regret and sadness. It's always back and forth. This is a person who has reached a crossroads of faith, life, death, and hope. He's crying out to God for assistance. And the end of the song really doesn't tell you what happens to this person's fate. But one thing is for sure, Weathered was Creed's last album before they broke up. The other members, minus Scott Stapp, moved on to form the band Alter Bridge. And then Stapp, of course, pursued a solo career. One Last Breath. Is that you? Does that describe you today? Do you feel like you're one last breath 6 feet from falling? Do you feel like you're standing on the absolute edge with no hope? That all you can see below you is 6 feet? That all you think of yourselves is, when I die, I'm nothing more than food for the worms. I'm insignificant. I have no hope, no future. There are many people living all over the world, in Iran, all over the world with no hope. That they're one last breath from 6 feet under. But the question is not all of the people all over the world. The question is you. Scott Stapp experienced his song quite dramatically throughout the course of his life. Even after he left Creed, the battle that he's facing today was so intense. The fame was overwhelming, and it was destroying his life. And so one day, in his darkest hour, one last breath before 6 feet under, Scott came back to his roots, the very roots the band Creed had been formed on, a spiritual alternative to other forms of music. And you heard from him in these successive interviews this morning. His book, Sinner Creed, is an exposing of himself. He is sharing with us the very things he would be ashamed to normally talk about in public, but he felt the need in the book Sinner's Creed to unveil who he really is, to talk about his past, his present, and the hope for the future. But the name of the book is insightful, Sinner's Creed. It gives us insight into why we struggle. We are all guilty before a holy God. We have broken his law. The choices we have made to haunt us. And we feel like one last breath 6 feet from the edge. You hear about it in the news. Suicide. Just where I live here in Florissant, across the river, is a prominent bar and grill with some of the very best shrimp and burgers, I think, anywhere. And one day, the owner of that bar and grill, the proprietor, took a gun to his head and killed himself. And the story is that he was facing some type of very serious illness and decided the way out was much easier. There was a story of a girl in the news, I think her name was Brittany. Not too long ago, she found out she was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. She went to the state of Washington, where they have a right to die program, and took a drug that ended her life instead of suffering. One last breath, 6 feet from the edge. What is it about these different scenarios? Is the one common denominator they have lost all hope. They feel life has cheated them, has wronged them, and that the only way of escape is death by suicide. Describe you today. Are you feeling hopeless like they did? Jesus came with these words in his first sermon. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me, for the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to comfort the brokenhearted and to proclaim that captives will be released and prisoners will be freed. Jesus has the key to open and let you out of your dark prison. And I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about a relationship with the God of the world who promises to heal your broken heart, to give you purpose like he gave Scott, and to release you from the fear and the trauma of your life. And today you can find hope in the resurrected Savior, Jesus Christ, who opens his arms wide open, another song by Creed, and invites you to know him personally and to find your hope and purpose in him. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He saves the crushed in spirit. Come to Jesus today. Simply ask him to forgive you and to heal you and to give you purpose in your life once again. I want to thank you, Vito. I want to thank you, Mary, and everyone in the chat room today. It was a pleasure to see you on the program. God bless you. I will see you next Monday on another edition of The Cross in the Desert. Have yourself an incredible weekend.
Great.